1 year ago, the Me Too movement was gaining traction across the country, and on this day, October 16th, a letter from 140 women in California politics was published alleging rampant sexual misconduct in state government, too. And that letter would launch the We Said Enough campaign. On Insight, one of the co-founders of We Said Enough, Adama Iwu, and its executive director, Samantha Corbin, will talk with me about measuring the results of change and how the Kavanaugh nomination and confirmation process has affected the movement. Then Dr. Lynn Farley joins me in the studio. She is the journalist who in 1975 started the phrase sexual harassment. Her work most recently has focused on the socialization of men. Later in the hour, Sac State political science professor Kim Nalder on this Year of the Woman 2.0. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. 1 year ago this week, in fact, 1 year ago today, a letter published in the LA Times officially started the We Said Enough campaign. That letter was signed by 140 women plus in California politics. They wrote that they were not shocked to hear the allegations against Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein because they said they too had experienced sexual harassment, even sexual assault, related to their work. In this hour, we're going to talk about the We Said Enough campaign in the midst of the national Me Too movement. And in a bit, we're going to meet the journalist who in 1975 originated that phrase, sexual harassment. But first, the leadership of We Said Enough. Samantha Corbin helped organize that letter published 1 year ago. She is executive director of what is now the nonprofit WSE Group, and she's in the studio. Samantha, glad to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
On the phone with us is Adama Iwu, who also helped launch that letter and co-founded WSE. She is its president. And you might remember that Adama landed on the cover of Time magazine as news of this letter and the stories behind it emerged. Hi, Adama. Glad to have you back on Insight.
Hi, good morning.
So to both of you, and Adama, you can start. When you were helping to organize this letter, did you have a vision or expectation of how it might be 1 year from now, you know, projecting into the future, Adama?
When we were writing it and working on it and kind of sending it around to women that we worked with, my main thing was hopefully this will serve as kind of a chilling effect. Kind of just a shot across the bow, like, look how many women are actually really angry about this. And we might in the past have laughed it off or let it go or brushed it under the rug, but we're tired of that. And I really just thought, okay, maybe people will see this, realize how angry we are, and some of this bad behavior will stop. That was really my big hope for this. The fact that it's gone so much further and that so many people in so many different industries and different legislatures and countries around the world have also said, you know, we're really angry about this too, is more than I could have possibly hoped or dreamed for.
Samantha?
I have a habit of what I call future fussing, sort of running every potential hypothetical scenario. So I would agree with Adama that, you know, I had some of those hopes, but I was also anticipating that people would want to talk to us, you know, maybe not us per se, Sam and Adama, but really talk to someone about this subject. And it was with that in mind that we set up the website and, you know, some methods of communication so that the conversation really could continue beyond just a letter. And so I anticipated there would be a big demand for conversation. I certainly didn't anticipate there would be as much as there is. But definitely thought this was something, at least in my experience, that women in particular were going to want to talk about a lot.
If this began for all of you under the dome or in Sacramento at the Capitol, and now, Adama, as you say, it's far and wide, what are you hearing about how it's present, how sexual misconduct in the workplace is seen and experienced around the world? I'd like to hear some of those far and away stories.
Yeah, so I actually was over in the UK earlier this year talking to some of the women who work in Parliament and who are members of Parliament. And they were saying that until very recently, like in the last few years, they would be talking and men would be kind of pantomiming, reaching out and touching parts of their body, making really inappropriate gestures, making really inappropriate comments about their fellow female ministers of Parliament. And how angry about that made them. We've heard from women in different industries saying that, it's like that in politics. It's like that here, too, in academia, in science, in national security, in the nonprofit space. So the stories that we've heard are all very similar. Women are having a very common experience. And I think that was really shocking to a lot of men to hear that, oh my God, is it really every woman I know in every job she's ever had? And every woman has emphatically said, yes, that is the experience. It does not change. Like we said in the letter, there's really nothing that insulates women from this. And then on a corollary note, this also happens to our LGBTQ friends. This also happens to men. This is really not about sex. It's about control and power.
I want to talk through a bit of the timeline, because it's easy to forget in a year what was happening last October. It was October 5th that the New York Times and then October 10th, the New Yorker, published those stories of sexual misconduct by Harvey Weinstein. And that seemed to launch the Me Too movement across the country, although a woman named Tarana Burke had started using that phrase back in 2006 or 7, and then actress Alyssa Milano picked it up in 2017, and through her tweets, it went viral. So it seemed new to many people a year ago. Meanwhile, October 9th, Dianne Feinstein announces her candidacy again to run for the U.S. Senate seat that she holds. The We Said Enough letter was published a year ago today on October 16th, and then Kevin DeLeon announced on October 18th that he would oppose Dianne Feinstein. So that was a lot of focus on the Capitol. Then comes the letter and more revelations. And Samantha, will you tell me about the frenzy of all of this in really what was the couple months of last fall?
Sure. And I think for context, you even have to go back a full year prior to that, because I believe it was October 5th, the year prior, that the Access Hollywood tapes with Donald Trump had come out, right before the November election. And women have since that time really been on a slow boil. There was the Women's March following the election and sort of this frustration that these double digits of women coming out against the president, frankly, were not so offensive enough that he couldn't be elected president. And so I think when you come up on the Harvey Weinstein story coming into the press and our letter and the climate at that time, women were at over a year of enormous frustration at that point, which is one of the reasons we really thought people would want to hear about this and talk about this. Certainly, in the Capitol in Sacramento all the way to D.C., this became a very intense conversation with Adama and I both regularly receiving calls from legislators in different states, receiving calls from staff in D.C. who really were having this shared experience. And frankly, when it comes to women in politics, you look at the numbers and we have so few women in high levels and in politics, period, as elected officials. And you don't have to wonder why that is. The women are, just like in many other fields, STEM fields, medical community, academia, they're being systemically harassed and discriminated out of the pipeline. And I think that you've seen a conversation and a narrative really form, particularly around the Feinstein and Kevin DeLeon race, because of her history and her coming into office as part of sort of the year of the woman following the Anita Hill hearings, and how contextual that history really is to what's happening right now.
We can't have this conversation right now and not talk about the impact of the Kavanaugh hearings. That race is only one piece of it. But Adama, can you speak to your listening to the testimony and the hearings and what women around you, women and men, part of this movement have said in response to it?
Yeah. So I had a friend reach out to me from D.C. very early and ask, you know, what do you think about the Kavanaugh thing? And I said, well, you'll know it that she's telling the truth when more women come out. And, you know, for a while, it looked like he was going to get away clear. And then more women did come out, and then more people came out to just say that's actually what he's saying about his behavior and how he comports himself for years is not true. And so going into this, I already, you know, kind of had a lot of feelings about this, and I think a lot of people did. Watching Dr. Ford, she seemed incredibly poised and credible, and it was clearly at great personal risk that she came forward, and there's really no earthly reason for her to. So that was, I think, very impactful to a lot of Americans and people around the world, because people around the world were watching this very closely. And then to watch his testimony, and frankly, I felt that his behavior, the way that he comported himself, was not judicial, did not display a judicial temperament. He came out yelling. He was disrespectful to senators, especially with his interchange with Senator Klobuchar. I think that that was actually kind of shocking. And I think that for a lot of women, I won't say all, obviously, but for a lot of women, it became very easily to see this as someone who might put their hand over someone's mouth and turn up the music to keep them quiet.
Adama, I'm going to jump in here because the debate that's been set off about who is believed or not believed, where is the blame, is an accusation real or false? To reflect on your letter from a year ago, I'll just read a bit of it because you were speaking to this at that time. The letter says, why didn't we speak up? Sometimes out of fear, sometimes out of shame. Often these men hold our professional fates in their hands. We don't want to jeopardize our future, make waves, or be labeled crazy, troublemaker, or asking for it. Worse, we're afraid when we speak up that no one will believe us or we will be blacklisted. We could spend the rest of our time talking about the reality and the stories, but can I ask in this year what you've seen in terms of outcomes or progress or results? Samantha, do you want to start?
Sure. You know, there's definitely, and Adam and I were reflecting on this recently, there's something of a bit of a playbook, I think, at this point, for those of us that have both been following the national news and frankly, have been personally involved in sort of hearing from very many victims and seeing their experiences be lived out. And there's a saying that we've used pretty regularly, which is, you know, these type of incidents, to Adama's point, are like cockroaches. If there's one on the floor, there's 10 in the wall. Abusers tend not to abuse just once. They tend to abuse with some kind of regularity. And unfortunately, in the past, and I think even you saw this even at the level of Dr. Ford, you know, there are no perfect victims. There's always reasons that if you wanted to discredit someone, you could tear them apart. And that fear really does keep women from coming forward. There is no fame and glory to be had in being a nationally known victim of sexual assault. It's that's farcical, that sort of this assumption that women come forward to get attention or sort of make these stories up. And when we launched the letter, one of the mottos that we had was no more Twitter justice. This idea that women are sort of having to trot their victimization out in the press to be believed and have action taken, when in reality, if you had functioning systems in which women could confidentially report, could be heard, if there were systems in place to actually be responsive to those issues and be proactive and promote resolution and healing, you wouldn't have the need for people to continuously go to the press or go public with this type of incident. And to some degree, we've seen various institutions try to get feelers around that to create more avenues for reporting. But by and large, and I would think Adama would agree with me, we're still really lacking the type of systems and best practices that will end the deluge of people feeling they have to go to the press to get recourse.
Adama, there have been a small number of lawmakers who have lost their jobs. There have been policy and procedural changes outside entities who will review complaints and look at investigations. You've spoken to us at least a couple times about feeling frustrated by the slow pace of change or the lack of true change. Where are you now, 1 year later?
I think we're still frustrated by the lack of true change and real change. The legislature has made some steps. They've actually allocated a budget. They've put forth a plan to start, you know, having a way to kind of deal with these claims in a little bit better of a way. But, I mean, we are still trying to find out what happens in an investigation. What is the outcome of an investigation? What is the process that they go through? So we're still waiting. And I think that that's really frustrating for a lot of people. I think one thing that has changed is that things actually are coming out now. There was an incident in the Capitol towards the end of session where a legislator used some really, I mean, crazy terms towards a female African-American lobbyist, and she reported it, and her job supported her 100% in reporting it, and it got to the papers. And I feel like a year ago, that wouldn't have happened. The wagons would have circled, it would have been swept under the rug, and no one would have ever heard about it. Mm-hmm. So people are losing kind of the timidity and fear about speaking up about things that happen, but we still have to have a process where those who are accused and those who bring accusations know exactly how that's going to be handled and adjudicated and can have some kind of expected outcome and a timeline for that.
We are going to post a link to your website, Adama and Samantha, and the stories still keep coming, I understand, from women. It does have the original letter on it and the work that you're doing since. Do you have a ballpark number of how many, you said the word victims, but women and or men that you've heard from?
Gosh.
God.
I don't know that we have a ballpark number. I can tell you that just in the first few days after the website was launched, we had over 20,000 hits to the website. And that was really just in the first couple days. But, you know, it's interesting. We've had reporters ask, you know, have things sort of slowed down? And the reality is they really haven't. I mean, I'm not sure that a week has gone by in the last year that I haven't heard from someone who's been victimized themselves or someone calling on behalf of a friend wondering sort of what resources they can avail themselves of. And, you know, the opportunities to speak even in front of large groups of people where almost every woman in the room has been victimized and is looking for solutions for these type of you know, systemic problems in their own community. I would say that it's basically every woman I speak to over the course of the last year.
Well, I want to thank you both. After a short break, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Lynn Farley, who in 1975 originated the phrase sexual harassment. She's going to agree with you because I have heard her say that every woman who has held a job has been sexually harassed. So that conversation is coming up. Meanwhile, thank you both. Adama, thank you for joining us today, and Samantha, too. It's 1 year since that letter was published, and I am sure that next year on the second anniversary, we'll be having a conversation with both of you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is Samantha Corbin and Adama Iwu. We will post a link to WeSaidEnough.com, and that's at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. There was a time when there wasn't a phrase or any common language for the experience of being mistreated in a sexual way at work. The phrase sexual harassment hadn't been coined, though women of all ages and all generations could tell stories that fit the description of what that phrase would come to mean. In the studio with me is the journalist who spent time thinking about what to call this behavior, and in 1975, she originated the phrase sexual harassment. She wrote a groundbreaking book titled Sexual Shakedown. There was a documentary, and a movement continued. She is Dr. Lynn Farley, and she's in our studio. Welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Will you tell the story of naming this behavior? And it starts in a class you were teaching at Cornell University about women and work.
Right. I was teaching a 15-credit field study course on women and work, and I had recruited so that I had both black and white female students, but it suddenly dawned on me that I was going to be put these Cornell co-eds in the field with working women, union members, welfare mothers, and I thought, you know, this could be a disaster from both sides, so I decided to do a little CR session about women in work and their work experience. And every single one of these kids from all over the country, I had 15 girls, and had an experience of either leaving a job or being fired because they would not respond positively to the sexual overtures of a manager, a boss, or even a coworker who had authority over them. And I remember just being stunned. I remember sitting there when the class was over and thinking, this is an issue. It is something that we all have experienced, and we have no name for it, so we keep calling it different things. Over here, one woman says, oh, he hit on me, and he just wouldn't take for an answer. And over here, we have a woman who says, you know, the guy was like an octopus. His hands were everywhere. We had a million ways to describe it, but not one phrase that was able to sum it up so that we all could be having the same conversation, talking about the same thing.
So you literally spent hours, days, over a couple of weeks thinking about how to name this.
That's right. And I talked with my friends and colleagues. We kept, you know, I kept coming up with this idea or that idea. I looked at coercion. I looked at blackmail. I looked at I just went through so many permutations and possibilities of how to describe this. And finally, it seemed to me sexual harassment of women on the job was the closest that we were going to get. And harassment captures the whole range of behavior because we go from offensive looks to offensive conversation all the way up through and including rape and sexual assault. But you have to get that whole range because women leave jobs because of that. I had a woman who told me that every morning her boss came in and he said to her as he walked by, "Hiya tits, how they hanging today?" And she left her job within a few months. I mean, how would you like to have, you know, if a man puts himself in those shoes, some guy comes in and says, "Hey, how are your balls? What's going on?" They're not going to take it. And this woman couldn't take it either. So I think we need to look at the whole range of offensive sexual behavior on the job.
It's so interesting to me that you were looking at it in a way in 1975 that still holds true today. Do you think the phrase means almost exactly what it did then, now?
Yes, exactly. I've got the long view here, 40-plus years of looking at what happens around this issue, what happens when we talk about it. It seems like every 15 years we reinvent the wheel. So in 1975, it was Lynn Farley and sexual harassment was named. The first syndicated article came out in the New York Times. Women responded overwhelmingly. 15 years later, we had Anita Hill, and it was like sexual harassment got reinvented all over again. And now we have Me Too and Christine Blasey Ford and another wave of sexual harassment awareness and focus, etc. But it seems as if we have these waves. There's tremendous interest. It seems as if we're making progress, and then it sort of all goes back down again until the next whatever that brings it all back into the public attention.
Because you said Anita Hill and Dr. Ford, I want to add the name that preceded that, which is Carmita Wood.
Yes. Carmita was a secretary at Cornell University. She had worked her way up over years, very wonderful woman who had gone as far as she could go in terms of what an administrative woman could do at Cornell. And she was sexually harassed by Cornell's only Nobel Prize winning physicist. She had to leave her job. She applied for unemployment insurance and was turned down. And, of course, she didn't have a way to talk about it either. She didn't say I was sexually harassed on the job. But anyway, we got together and I said, we'll take your case. We'll appeal your unemployment claim. But you need to be willing to talk about this issue, and that's going to make you fairly notorious in the town of Ithaca. So I want you to go home. I want you to think about it very carefully. I want you to talk to your family, because this is a big step that you're going to take. And she came back at the end of the weekend and said she was ready. Carmita was a fighter, and we did take her unemployment claim, but she talked about what happened to her in vivid detail, and that's extremely important. Carmita was, I would say, a very courageous woman, and she did a great job in terms of talking about sexual harassment. At the same time, you had a black woman, Diane Williams, who sued the Justice Department of the United States. Those two were extremely early pioneers, one black, one white.
Carmita Wood didn't have anyone else to look to for guidance. She knew she was standing alone in the trail she was blazing.
Yes. Well, she had us. And when she became unemployable in Ithaca, which she did, I got her hired at HAP. And she worked with the Human Affairs Program for a while. And then when the Human Affairs Program disbanded, she moved down to Florida and kind of started a new life there. But her life essentially was employable anyway, was over in Ithaca when she came out and was a spokesperson.
What have you come to understand about how sexual harassment is used as a strategy or a tool, or I'll be stronger in the wording, a weapon? In the workplace,
it is a weapon in the workplace. In non-traditional job areas for women, it is a technique that is used to keep women out, to harass them literally until they just don't want any part of the job. In traditional female job areas, it keeps high turnover, so you don't have to pay higher wages. You don't have to deal with unionization. You see it in the fast food industry. You know, young girls are like Kleenex in the fast food industry. And I would say, I mean, I can't prove it at this point, but within that industry, it's well known that sexual harassment is an issue and nothing is done about it because it keeps turnover high and they don't have to deal, like I said, with higher wages, et cetera.
So in those 15-year cycles that you're describing, is there change with each cycle?
No. I am a doomsayer, I'm afraid. I've got 40-plus years at this. I haven't seen much change at all. You have more sexual harassment cases today than you did probably when I was starting out. We have not made a dent on this issue. And, you know, every 15 years, it seems as if women kind of reinvent the wheel. I talked with Gretchen Carlson, did a long interview with her. She sued, you know, Roger Ailes at Fox, got $20 million. She thinks she invented sexual harassment. It was the same thing with Anita Hill. Anita Hill never talked about the women who came before her, about the movement that whose shoulders she stood on. And it was only like 10 to 15 years that the whole issue got started. This seems to be a phenomenon in women's history. I know when the second wave of the women's movement started, we all thought that we had invented many of these issues. But when I started reading, we hadn't invented these issues at all. They had been around in the first wave. So I think this is something we also need to address. We have to stop thinking every 15 years that we're making huge progress because we're talking about something that 15 years ago women were talking about.
Maybe we haven't spoken enough. Because you were going to be here today, I had a conversation on my way to work with my mom, who worked as a nurse her entire career. I heard stories today, Dr. Farley, that I have never, ever heard. And they just kept pouring out and pouring out. And I have a great relationship with my mom. Why did we never have this conversation before? Anyway, we're going to take a short break. Will you stay with us?
Of course.
We're going to talk a little bit more about where your work is today. This is Dr. Lynn Farley. By the way, she has two public lectures tomorrow at noon in Davis. She will be at the UC Davis Genome and Biomedical Science Facility Auditorium. And then tomorrow at 5 p.m. in Sacramento at the UC Davis Sacramento Campus Education Building, the Matsui Lecture Fisher Hall, she'll speak again. We'll be right back. Our conversation will continue on Insight. Listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. More now with author and journalist Dr. Lynn Farley, who in 1975 originated the phrase sexual harassment. We're talking today on the one-year anniversary of the We Said Enough letter that was published and signed by more than 100 women in California politics. You published an op-ed a year ago at this time, and in the op-ed, not directly related to the We Said Enough letter, you wrote about the fact that the decades, you said, have been disappointing, that sexual harassment as a concept has been a success, but it's done far less to encourage what you had envisioned back in 1975, which would flourish. Would you say something about that?
I thought working women, you would unite around the issue. I thought it was an issue that cut through all of the class, race lines that divides women at work. It's something that happens to all working women, regardless of age, regardless of sexual orientation, regardless of class background, regardless of race. And I thought, like rape, it would unite women and there would be a revolution for women at work.
Why hasn't that happened?
Well, you know, number one, women are so unheard in our culture that when they are heard, they stop there. We're so grateful to be listened to. We are so grateful that somebody is paying attention to our experience. And I think it's very critical that we move beyond that. We move beyond being grateful. If you look at Christine Blasey Ford, she was so eloquent. She was so careful in her speech and her demeanor. You know, it was a big deal for her to come forward and talk about what she did. Let's not talk about the guy on the other side and his behavior. But I think we have to stop being nice and we have to stop being grateful that we're being listened to and we have to take it to the next step. We have to say, you know, it's great that you're listening to us, but now we want it to stop.
How different would that hearing have been if she had come out angry and blazing and in some of the emotion that he came out with?
I don't know. We don't know because we don't risk it. As women, we very rarely take that chance. I don't know what would have happened. I don't think it could have been worse. I think, you know, you had 13 men on that committee that were the same 13 men that crucified Anita Hill almost, what, how many years ago? The same men sitting on the committee crucifying another woman.
So there was a time when you dipped out of this whole arena, too. You pulled back. And I have heard you say in videos that you were tired of being that sexual harassment lady.
Right.
And you wanted to take a break. Part of that was because of the pounding you were taking.
That's true. You know, when Sexual Shakedown, the book, came out, I did every major radio and TV show in America. And then I did another round when the paperback came out. And again, you know, I'm sort of talking about myself. I was very grateful. I was so happy that people were listening to me and I had an opportunity, a platform to get the information out there and to reach other women. But, you know, every show that I showed up for, the woman producer would come out and say, oh, Lynn, it's a groundbreaking work. We're all so impressed. But, you know, Johnny or Merv or Jack is going to appear to attack you because it'll be better box office. And I just went along and said, okay, yes, sure. And all I did when they were beating me up, and they did, was try and get the information out there to the audience. And later on, I realized that took a toll. It's very hard when you don't stand up for yourself, when you don't say enough, when you don't say you can't do that. The only time that I really stood up was on a radio show in Chicago, and the host was very polite and nice to me. But two girls called in when I talked about the fast food industry who were working at a place where they had to perform sexual favors in order to keep their job. And those two kids needed that job. And when they called in and talked about their experience, he and they went off the air. He called them whores. He said, those little whores. And I said, whoa, you know, you can say whatever you want to me, but you cannot insult these kids because I'm on your show. And they felt safe enough to call in. And I said, we're done. And I walked off the show. And of course, you know, that's something you don't do. You do not leave the leader of the show with dead airtime. And I thought, oh, God, McGraw-Hill is going to really crucify me now. They're going to be so upset. It turned out that was not the case. They were, like, elated because people ran out and bought the book. So it was good publicity for them. I think they went so far as to say, can you do it again? And I was like, well, I don't think so.
Let me fast forward to where your work has resurfaced. You jump back into this, taking the perspective of the socialization of men. You did your doctorate work on this, and all of that was before this year when we've been so focused on Kavanaugh and the Me Too movement. So what are you looking at now? What have you been writing about?
Well, you know, my doctoral dissertation was The Secret World of Men. Men's attitudes, beliefs, behaviors, and desires with regard to women and children. And, you know, we socialize men to behave this way. We need to face that. Men are socialized to be attracted to younger, smaller sex objects. We're appalled when we see men, you know, sleeping with 12-year-old girls or whatever, or when we see Western men lined up too deep around the block in Thailand to go to a brothel where they have 8- and 9-year-old girls for sale. But this is the way we socialize men. This is what we teach them to want. Now we also have the pornography. You know, in my book, The Secret World of Men, I have a fellow who told me, he comes right out and talks about it. He cannot sleep with his wife anymore because he's so far gone on pornography that he cannot get it off unless he has some sort of pornographic behavior going on. And he doesn't want to do that to his wife. The man sat and cried. And this is all stuff going on under the radar that we're not talking about and we're not looking at.
So now you are talking about yet another social revolution that would have to happen. Mm-hmm. Is the first and critical step in that this dialogue and openness about the reality, the victim stories, if you will?
I think the victim stories are important, but we have never really moved on to the perpetrator stories, and we need the perpetrator stories. What motivates you to do this? Why do you behave this way? What's going on with you? You know, little boys do not pop out of the womb all set to behave this way.
But we don't get those stories if the response is, what do you mean? I don't do it. I didn't do it.
Well, you know, the truth is, I think probably half of the men in the workforce do it. And the other half look the other way, don't want to get involved, wash their hands of it, because they do not want to appear to contradict other men in the workplace. I mean, that's a huge other issue that goes on with men. Men will not contradict each other. If they don't approve of what's going on, but they will not. I'll give you an example of this. I did a show in Chicago. It was another call-in show. And a lawyer called in, and truthfully, he bested me in the conversation, and he kept saying, look, I'm a lawyer, I hire nothing but pretty women, and you're not going to stop me from doing it. And I just sort of was constantly playing catch up with him. And when the show was over, the producer came out and said, you know, 4 men called in and said he's a total jerk. He's not liked in the profession, and they know what he's doing with women. And I said, why didn't you put them on the air? And he said they wouldn't go on the air. They were willing to talk about it privately, and that goes on with men all the time. You will have a man go up to a woman who's being harassed and say, I'm sorry, I see what's happening, I know it's wrong, but they will not stand up.
Meanwhile, how many women have been sexually harassed? What's your guess?
You know, the statistics have never changed. 40 years ago, when we did the Red Book questionnaire, 70% of women said they had been sexually harassed. If you look at the stats that have come out around the Me Too movement, 70% of women are saying they are sexually harassed in the workplace. It has not varied. It has not changed. It's way more than 50% or half. And if a woman hasn't experienced it directly, she has seen it in the workplace. She's seen it with other women. It's phenomenally widespread.
So what are you hopeful about in your lifetime as your work continues? Because it seems that you are reconnected and reinvested.
I would love to see the book about how we socialize men to behave this way. I would like to see that see the light of day. But I think we also need to understand.
Do you mean it doesn't have a publisher?
No, it doesn't.
You can't get it published?
I haven't really tried very hard. I'm waiting for an agent to come and find me. But I think also working women need to look to themselves for this. I don't think management is going to do it. I don't think HR programs are going to do it. Women need to organize on the job themselves. And I think that's going to be the next step.
Dr. Farley, it has been a pleasure. I appreciate this time with you, and I'm glad that you're here for two public lectures for people who want to hear more from you.
Thank you.
So Dr. Farley will be at Davis, at the UC Davis Genome and Biomedical Science Facility tomorrow at noon. Her speech is Sexual Harassment Today, Yesterday, and Tomorrow. And then at 5 p.m. tomorrow, she's at the UC Davis Sacramento campus, the Education Building. Her speech is Sexual Harassment, The Backstory. I think you could end up on tour again. I hope that book gets published. And I want to offer you a standing invitation to come and join us at any point that you're in the area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That is Dr. Lynn Farley. Our conversation on this topic will continue after a short break. This is Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. So what has the impact of the Me Too movement been in California? And what are the implications for this Year of the Woman 2.0, as it's being called? Those are some of the questions that will be explored tomorrow evening at a community panel discussion. It starts at 6 at the new Sac State downtown location, which is 304 S Street. Two political science professors from Sac State will lead the conversation. One is joining me in the studio, Professor Kim Nalder. Hi, Kim. It's always great to have you on Insight.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So give me some of your reaction to what you've heard throughout this hour.
This has been a fascinating discussion. I've taught women in politics at Sac State for many years, and I think that Dr. Farley made an excellent point, which our students have started to make over time. They didn't in the early years, but now they're starting to make this point, which is, why is this a discussion among women about women? Shouldn't we be talking about the perpetrators and their point of view? And you could argue that our panel tomorrow night really should have men explaining, you know, their point of view, or, you know, why is it that men perpetrate this sort of thing in the workplace. But instead, it's on the shoulders of women to deal with.
Has this given you a little bit of a sudden paradigm shift in where to take this in the classroom? And as we focus on women's stories from Hollywood to politics, is there another dimension?
There is. And, you know, I think that the Kavanaugh hearings really brought out a lot of this idea of victim blaming, right? We saw, as has already been discussed this hour, but we saw, you know, lots of defense of men and worry about men's possibility of being, you know, wrongly accused of sexual harassment as a reaction in our culture, even in 2018. I, for years, have showed some clips from the Anita Hill testimony and in my Women in Politics class, and students were always shocked and thought it couldn't happen or wouldn't happen that way today. And so I think it's been a real wake-up call and demoralizing comment on our culture to see that we really haven't come as far as I think most of us imagined we had.
Have you asked for their stories? Dr. Farley talked about back in 1975 asking the young students to describe their work experiences in the context that we're talking of sexual harassment. Have you asked them what they're living with?
I don't tend to ask those questions openly in class because some students feel like it's a sensitive topic. I tend to hear it in office hours or, you know, after class they come and talk to me. You know, some students right now in my political psychology class are talking about how they're being triggered by discussions of this. I think it's pretty pervasive.
So what's social media doing to either allow a platform, open up the conversation, or create backlash and shaming and cyberbullying?
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting or maybe demoralizing things that's also coming about is that social media gives all of us access to contact with other people, to a mass media platform, essentially, that we wouldn't have had a generation ago. And so the stories are getting out. The Me Too movement, I mean, immediately when Me Too became a hashtag, you saw people all over the internet coming forward with stories, and that's continuing today. But at the same time, there's that backlash. There's the, you know, sort of Gamergate kind of response that women get when they do come out and tell their stories. And the anonymization of the internet allows for people to say and do things that they wouldn't in face-to-face interaction. And so, you know, it's really a double-edged sword. You know, the information gets out, but there's also the pushback and women end up being afraid.
Was the We Said Enough letter published a year ago today a flashpoint? Did that letter have enough power to be a game changer?
I think in a way it does. California tends to be ahead of the rest of the country in all kinds of areas of policy and social movements. And I think that the reaction in California was stronger than we saw in D.C. or in other state houses across the country. We got a lot of national coverage over the We Said Enough movement here in the state. And so I think, you know, the rest of the country will be watching what happens here if the culture does change in the Capitol. There have been some reforms. They did, you know, an outside investigation. Some people lost their jobs. So there were some consequences and some changes that took place. It's just a matter of how long lasting that is. Will we be 20 years from now having the same conversation and being demoralized again? Or does this end up being a turning point? I don't think we can tell a year out yet. You know, we can be hopeful, but I think a lot of people are feeling a lack of that hope after the Kavanaugh hearings.
That's the challenge Dr. Farley just put out, is what can happen in the interim that prevents just another 15 or 20 year cycle of somewhat same, different generation?
And I think she made an excellent point, which is, you know, back to that idea that it can't just be women dealing with this issue. It can't just be African-Americans dealing with racism against Black people. It needs to be everyone, right? And men need to call other men to account and to not accept the culture of locker room talk.
So the implications of all of this on Year of the Woman 2.0, and what will linger from the country's mass experience of the Kavanaugh hearings?
Yeah, we're seeing more women and more people of color running for office this year. In our panel tomorrow night, we have a first-time candidate who was motivated by the Me Too movement to run for office. And so, you know, it should be interesting to sort of see what people are talking about. So we have Jacqueline Moreno, who will be there. We also have a longtime staffer and head of the Capitol Black Staff Association, Shannon McKinley, will be there. So she'll have some commentary about what it means for intersectionality for women of color, in particular in the Capitol. And then a political reporter, Laurel Rosenhall, who is with Cal Matters, who's been reporting on this. So many reporters have been doing excellent work here in California. Mm. I mean, we've been concerned for years about the lack of political reporters who are sort of full-time on the beat on state politics in general. But I think, you know, one of the bright things that we can see out of this is that there's been so much excellent reporting from the LA Times, from the Sacramento Bee, from the AP, from CAP Radio, on this topic here in California?
Well, for many of us, a body of work has been compiled because people are saying, yes, I'll talk to you. Yes, I'm available. Yes, let's have this conversation. And I think that's more of what you're trying to do tomorrow night. Is it open to the public?
It's absolutely open to the public. We encourage as many people who would like to come to come. It's at 3rd and S at the New Sacramento State Downtown. It's a part of downtown that's not as difficult to find parking in, at least, right? It's a quieter section of the grid. So hopefully people will show up and have a live discussion about this.
You and Professor Danielle Martin will lead that discussion. Again, it's 6 p.m., the start time tomorrow night. We'll post a link. I want to say thanks to all the guests in the studio. And I'm going to close, Kim, by asking you the same question that I asked Dr. Farley, and that is, what are you hopeful about? What are you looking toward a realistic and possible shift that moves all of us to a better place?
I am somewhat hopeful. We were talking in the green room about this, about how, you know, if you watch Mad Men and look at the workplace environment that's depicted there.
From the 50s
and from the early 60s. And you realize that the acceptability levels have shifted. And the millennials and the generation after them, Gen Z, which is our, you know, freshmen in college now, they don't find these things to be acceptable. I think there has been a shift in the culture with the Me Too movement. And, you know, maybe that's why 20 years from now it will be different, because a new generation will come up not accepting this sort of behavior.
Thank you so much. As I said, it's always a pleasure, Professor Nalder.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Sac State political science professor Kim Nalder. There are links related to the conversation today at capradio.org/insight. And that is Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.